This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for coming to this, the final event of Animal Law Week. I want to thank you all for your support of Animal Law Week, which I think by all accounts has been a great success, and hopefully the first of what will be many Animal Law Weeks. So our final event today is on the pet food recall. And so we have here Drs. Barb Royal and Dan McChesney. Dr. Royal has her own practice, the Royal Treatment Veterinary Spa. It focuses on holistic treatment of animals, and she's also a consultant to zoos. And Dr. McChesney is director of the Office of Surveillance and Compliance for the FDA's Veterinary Medicine. So then we will have a wrap-up with Vince Field, who's University of Chicago class of 2011. So before we begin, one last note. We would like to thank once again the McCormick Companion Animals Fund, which has made this and the entire week possible. So without further ado, Dr. McChesney, thanks.
Well, thank you. It's quite a pleasure to be here. Just as sort of an aside, I have a PhD in cell molecular biology, but I actually have two attorneys who report directly to me. And the FDA has several attorneys throughout this organization. And the one thing that's it's very interesting is we get in a room and we'll talk somewhat of a regulatory issue. And so the scientists always like to talk about the law and how much they know about the law. And attorneys always like to talk about the science. And then we come back to reality and we realize that we should probably stick to what we know best. Not to belabor the point of a legal thing, but just a couple slides on some of the constraints that FDA has to operate under. So it would be nice to say, oh, take that off the market. But we do have to, there are some legal constraints. So there's three slides here, not to belabor the point, but just to sort of frame the background in case you're not familiar with food and drug law. FDA is charged with enforcing the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and also parts of the Public Health Service Act. Well, how do we get in the pet food business? Well, we got in the pet food business because the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act defines food as articles used for food or drink for man or other animals, and obviously pets are the other animals, but also horses, cows, pigs, or other animals. And the important point of this, we can go through all, and I'm sure at some point in your careers here you'll go through this, but FDA regulates really under two provisions of the Act. Either the product is adulterated, meaning there's something wrong with it, or it's misbranded. And there are a few other things we regulate under, but those are the two major ones that we have to prove. And the other point that we believe is we just can't tell someone, oh, we think that there's wrong with that. We have to be able to back it up. So under the adulteration provisions, we won't go through these. And I'll leave the slide set for Vince, and he's welcome to share however he wants with the group. But under the adulteration provisions, if we want to charge someone with any of these to get their product off the market, we have to be able to prove it, because they can take us to court, and we'll have to stand before a judge and say, this is why we think it's so. And the other point to bear here is that if you say, well, it's a poisonous, delirious substance injurious to your health, well, at a certain level, that may be true. But at some other level, that may not be true. And so what do you say then? How do you marry that up? So if you're going to charge somebody, you have to pick something that sort of fits all the circumstances, like contains not approved additive. That just means it shouldn't be there. It's not approved. So those are the adulteration provisions. Misbranding basically has to be, the labeling has to be true. It can't be false or misleading. This other piece down here talks about dietary supplements, and while it's part of the law, for the pet side, we don't use it too much. So when we go through this, just think about when we wanted to act against these products, we either have to say they're adulterated or they're misbranded, or they could be both. Significance of the human side of any pet food safety issue. Well, the sale of pet food is a $13 billion spent annually on pet food. Huge. Pet food is an animal feed, but it's marketed similar to food that you and I eat. There's similar presentations and promotions. Low-cal pet food, diet pet food, low-salt pet foods, similar points of purchase. We were just talking, you go into a food store, at least in my area, I assume in this area, pet food's the only product in the store that has a whole aisle to itself. Just think about that. That's a lot of marketing power. Same point of use, same people who buy food for, you know, for your families, generally the people who buy pet food. And because of that, they expect the same degree of oversight for pet food as they do for human food. And obviously, as part of this, you can end up with pet food and being in the food for food-producing animals. Just some of the facts, and we'll go over this. We don't want to belabor it. We learned about this back a year ago on March 16th. Menu Foods, which was the manufacturer, couldn't find anything else wrong with their product. They had changed suppliers, so they suspected wheat gluten, although they had no proof of any problem. On March 30th, FDA found melamine in the wheat gluten, which turned out to be the problem. And then about a month later, well, 2 weeks later, we found it in rice protein concentrate. But why would it be in there? The only reason to put melamine in wheat gluten or rice protein content is to increase its apparent quality in protein content. So it turns out the straight economic adulteration, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It was put in there by the Chinese to make a cheap product look better. Within 24 hours, FDA had folks out there. Investigators were sent to all pet food and feed manufacturers involved. There were thousands of these. There's a map in some of these presentations where it starts out with one or two dots, and by the time we were done, you could barely see the United States. We went back to China to look at the manufacturing sites, and when FDA got there, they had been bulldozed. So we got to see the site, but it was just a pile of rubble. And we were also seeing how effective the recall was at the same time. On April 27th, we finally said enough and put an import alert that required detention without physical examination of 11 different vegetable proteins from China. This was a countrywide import alert. The interesting legal aspect of it, other than we were able to do this, is that you have to show, the way you put an import alert in is you have to show there's a problem with a product. So if Vince has got a product coming into the United States, and I find a problem that everything he sends me there's always a problem with, I could put his product on import alert. Now, if someone else has a problem, I could put theirs on. If I wanted to put all of your products that were coming in, I'd have to show that there was some reasonable expectation there would be a problem from all of your products. That's a countrywide import alert. So that's a pretty big burden to have to show that everybody in this room, I suspect that none of your products are any good. Now, I can't necessarily prove that because I haven't tested everyone, but I have to make a case before our staff attorneys and anyone else who would challenge us that there's a reasonable expectation of that. So putting a countrywide import alert in, it seems intuitive, the right thing to do, but there are some real legal challenges in that. It got worse. You know, how much worse could it get? It went to all these pets. Well, just because of the way food is used in the United States, when they make pet food, if something falls off, they scrape it up, the stuff that comes out early. Well, you know, that's not quite up to standard for pet food. All that goes to animal feed. So it goes to food for hogs and chickens in this case. And so what happened here, we originally found it went here, and there were originally about 1,000 hogs in North Carolina that we thought were fed the food. And the thought then was, well, you know, we can just, USDA will just buy these animals and it'll be done. Well, then it expanded. By the time it was over, there were 56,000 hogs quarantined in several states and 20 million, that's 20 million broiler chickens. That's a lot of chickens. And so all these were held off the market for about a month. Now, you say, well, that's not a big deal. Well, if you're one of these people that are raising these hogs or these chickens, chickens, really, it's like 46 days if you're a broiler from egg to the supermarket. So every day you hold, even if you only paid a penny, if you had to pay a penny a day to hold a chicken, every day you hold that chicken one more day to go to market, when you've got 20 million, the 20 million pennies add up pretty quick. And so that gets to be a huge economic impact. Same with hogs. So these farmers really wanted to get these animals to market. because it was costing them, every day they held them, it cost money. Contaminated fish feed was shipped from Canada to the U.S., so we ended up with some aquaculture problems. And the most incredible piece of this whole story is a company in Ohio called Henbeck continued to add melamine to the, as a binder to the fish feed 2 months after this was all over the paper. That's just, I mean, I don't even have words for that. Pet food complaints. FDA received over 18,000 consumer complaints during this, about a six-week time period. To put that in perspective, in a normal year for all the other FDA-regulated products, which are all the food products, all our human drug products, all our vaccines, all blood products, all medical devices, we receive less than 6,000 calls a year. So in a six-week period, we received, on pet food, three times as many calls as we receive an entire year on all other products. Our pet food page received 6.1 million hits between in that time period, and our own web page at CVM received over 1.3 million. That just gives you an idea of the scope of this problem and the interest in pets. Sort of the lessons learned here, so this kind of goes to what are we going to do now, what did we see? 15% of the U.S. food supply is imported, and it's going up daily. And the amount we see is doubled in 5 years. And we regulate virtually all of this coming in, FDA does. FDA responded, we have 20 district offices, 400 employees were mobilized. We worked a long time trying to determine what the contaminant was. It took a long time to do that. It's not easy. There were complaints later on when people said, well, why didn't you tell us this sooner? Why didn't you find out melamine was here? Why couldn't you release those animals sooner? Well, the truth of the matter is, people, you know, I watch CSI and you watch all these other crime scene things, and it's solved in 45 minutes, these complicated things. That's just not real life. We were going as fast as we could, and you want to be sure that it's, you know, the information is accurate. So it just takes a while for these to go through the process. Some of these analyses take 2 or 3 days. So you just can't solve that in 45 minutes. It's a complex domestic market. Food comes from it all around the world. And there's really no easy way to separate that. The importance of an effective food safety program was just truly emphasized by this, whether it's pet food or the food we eat. We really need an effective system. And the system obviously wasn't as effective as it could be. Big impact. We only had two suppliers in China, two suppliers that were sending product in that caused all this problem. There were 11, the result was 11,000 individual products. And of those 1,100 individual products represented millions of servings, something like 1% of all the pet food in the United States. That's a lot. Lesson two. Well, we need to talk about the science because people want to know what's going on. And you need to realize up front that if you go out and say, oh, I don't think that's a problem, or don't worry about that, 2 days later you've got to come back and tell them, well, now that is a problem. That's not a good message. You're better to kind of, you know, bite your tongue and say, here's what we know now. As we get more information, we'll tell you. We're not high in it. We just don't know. You really need to go back and rely on the science and go with the science and be open and communicative about it. Melamine had an interesting thing. Melamine by itself, if you look at toxicology studies, not toxic at all. It turns out when melamine is present with a couple other similar compounds, it causes crystals. Information from pet food companies, they provide a lot of information to the analysis. Procter & Gamble did very sophisticated analysis of their pet food products and were actually the first ones to come up with melamine cyanuric acid. Risk assessment. Well, now that you've got these, now that we know we have 56,000 hogs out there and 20 million chickens, well, the only reason they got held up is because we knew feed went to them. But is there any expectation to think that prior to us knowing this, this wasn't going on for 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months, you pick your time frame? The answer is no. And so now you have, what's your message to the folks in this room? You, your families, your children. I've been eating chicken, I've been eating pork. should I be concerned? Well, that's the answer you have to, people want to know. Should I be concerned about this? And what it took us a while to get to this answer because we had no data. And finally, after about a month or a month and a half, we actually had accumulated enough data where we could do, we had the ability to do a risk assessment and make some estimates on what the animals ate, how that would show up in something one of us might eat. And what we found, and you could go through the science of this and we could tell you how much the total daily intake was and a bunch of that, but you know, people just glaze over if that's in the newspaper. That's just not a sound bite, doesn't get your interest, just doesn't do much for you. What does do for you is that if you're a 132-pound person, you'd have to eat 800 pounds of contaminated meat daily to be at risk. So that says your risk is pretty small, okay? You know, the vast majority of these people in this room would probably have to eat close to 800 pounds of meat a day or more. So that's not going to happen. So that sort of gives you a feeling of, well, I've eaten this, I may have eaten this, I may have fed my family, but you know, the risk is not so great. So it's important when you try to communicate information on risk to do it in a way that people can understand. Importance of stakeholders in communicating risk. Stakeholders help protect the health of many dogs and cats. As we said, the pet food companies did a lot of research. They provided data. We had university labs, FDA labs doing the methods. We actually used the press to disseminate information. In the period you saw up there from March to May, we had, in the first week, we were having press conferences almost daily. And after that, we went to a press conference every couple days. But the important is that over this six-week period, we had close to 20 press conferences. And the importance is disseminate the information, get it out there so people can ask, say, here's what we know, here's what we're doing. Here's our, you know, next steps. Communicate risk to stakeholders. It says the FDA webpage conveyed huge amounts of information on the products that were recalled. One of the questions we had up front and one of the problems we had is that we would put up the product that was recalled on our webpage and it would say, go to such and such company to see the product that was recalled. A lot of people, it's probably, you know, folks in this room, I suspect, don't think about it, because I'll admit, I didn't think about it, and most of the folks at FDA didn't think about it. There's lots of people in this country that still don't have readily access the internet. And so putting things up on the internet and saying someone who lives in a very small town maybe has to go to the library to go to get to the internet isn't very useful to that person. So communicating that way is not a useful approach. Putting it in the major paper, put it in the Chicago Tribune, and then looking at some place in lower Illinois that's a very small town where they, you know, the Chicago Tribune, maybe some of the library gets, the library in next county gets, but it's not there, isn't a good one. So how do you get that out? That's a real challenge. It's still a challenge. What we did do finally is we put all the recall products on the web, on the FDA webpage, so at least if you had web access, you only had to go to one place. You didn't have to go to each company website. That's a help. It's not a perfect solution, but it was a help. We shared analytical methods with academia and regulators, and we partnered, as we've already said, we partnered with media to get the word out as quickly as possible and also as completely as possible. Well, what was the outcome of this? The FDA over the years has been, at least in the past couple of years, has been criticized for not doing enough in food safety and in a variety of safety issues. But one of the things that came out of this, and pet food was, at least in my view, was really a tipping point to show that people realized if this can happen to pet food, this can surely happen to any other food in this United States. And that was a wake-up call, for everybody. So what came out of that was a new law called the FDA Amendments Act of 2007. And there's lots of things in there. There's 10 titles in there. But Title 10 is the one that deals with pet food, and so it's a part of this talk. Well, they said within 2 years, we need to come up with ingredient standards. People like to know when they pick up a can and read it, well, you know, instead of saying chicken parts, they'd like to know what those chicken parts are. So what are ingredient standards? How do you process it? Are there processing standards for pet food? There are industry-established standards, but in general, there are no federal standards for processing. Labeling standards, nutritional ingredient, nutritional information, and ingredients. If you pick up a can and you read it, and you don't know what's in it, it doesn't do you much good. Or if it tells you to feed your animal by some method that you don't, no one ever feeds it, you know, what good does that do? If it says 1 cup, well, maybe that's a good thing. If it says feed your animal 6 ounces a day, you know, who knows what that means? I mean, it means 6 ounces, but how are you going to judge that? So, you know, we're looking to improve labeling information so it's just easier to read. And they said to do this with in consultation with stakeholders, and stakeholders are, you know, consumers, the pet food industry, and states, and other federal agencies. Other provisions must establish an early warning surveillance notification system. One of the problems of this was how many animals were really involved. We know there were millions of animals involved, and how many really became sick, well, we don't really know. And how many died, we really don't know. I mean, numbers can go from a few hundred to 10 or 20,000. There's just no good source of that. So we're working on improving that notification system using some of the larger pet hospitals and involved, like there's a listserv out there called pet, is it VetNet? So we're looking at using
veterinary
listserv. So using information from that and working better to get that. Reportable food. Part of this calls that if there's a problem with the food, it needs to be reported. There's no requirement to do that now. And it says we must identify what a reportable food is. Must be done within a year. Important point of this is, when do you report this? Take my science hat off and put a legal spin on this. When do you report a reportable food? Because there's a problem with the food. If I make a food and I think there's a problem with it, when do I call up and notify the FDA? Do I determine whether there truly is a problem with it before I call? Or do as soon as I think there's a problem, do I call? Well, if I just called FDA, that could maybe do that either time. Well, they want this to be public. They want this to be public access information. So that means if I call FDA, it needs to go up on some public forum. When do I want that put up? Do I want to be sure of my information before it goes up? Or should it go up at any time? You know, if it goes up at any time, as soon as I think about it and there's nothing wrong with it, I've damaged my, obviously had a huge amount of economic damage to my company. If I wait, then I've impacted, and it truly is a problem, then I've impacted public health. So, you know, what's the right time and who gets to decide that and how do we do that? So while there are lots of things in this Food, Drug, Cosmetic Act, the implementation of it, and so considering some of the legal ramifications of it and how one would address everybody's due process in this and still get this out, can prove to be a challenge. So while it's a good idea, the implementation of some of these things can prove to be challenging. The Food Protection Plan, we only have a couple slides to go here. What came out of this was also a Food Protection Plan you may have heard about. FDA in the past has been very good about responding. When we heard about the pet food thing, we responded excellently, at least I think. But we surely did a lousy job of preventing it in the first place. Right? If we'd been doing a better job of prevention, we could have not had the problem. But we did. So the Food Protection Plan looks to turn this over. We're putting more emphasis on prevention, build safety in from the start. Building safety into the start, in many ways, translates, even though it's not set up there, is into more regulation. And you can, depending on what your view is on how industry, should industry regulate itself or should the federal government regulate industry or some mix of that, will make that more challenging or less challenging. Intervention, once we find a problem, let's work on intervening. We're pretty good at that. And responding, we're really good at that, but we prefer not to have to respond. We prefer to prevent. Cross-cutting, this is the last slide. We want to focus on the risk of the product's life cycle from production to consumption. If, in fact, we could have prevented melamine from going into wheat gluten in China, we never would have had the problem at the end. If, in fact, you imported it, had tested the product, we wouldn't have had the problem. You have to go back to the basic ingredients to see how you prevent a problem. That's the life cycle complex, or life cycle concept. You want to target resources to achieve maximum risk reduction. I think that's pretty straightforward. You know, we're probably not so interested in vitamins for reptiles, you know, vitamins for your iguana. If you said, well, should I go out and try to take vitamins for my iguana off the market, or should I concentrate on pet food or human food safety? You know, that's sort of the risk reduction. You probably want to concentrate on the other ones. Where do you look? Do you look at the top of where, if somebody screws it up here, you know, and then a product goes downhill and it goes to 100 different places, you want to regulate at the top, not at the bottom, because here you've got 10 people to regulate, down here you've got 1,000. That's risk reduction. Where do you put that information? You have to address both unintentional and deliberate contamination. What we saw in melamine was deliberate contamination. There's unintentional contamination going on all the time. Somebody just makes an honest mistake and they put the wrong product, you know, they put too much of it in, or they don't look at a temperature. You know, we need to catch that, but we also need to catch the deliberate, and the deliberate is much harder to catch than the unintentional. We have to use science and modern technology, including enhancing IT systems. A lot of government IT pieces don't talk to each other. It's a real problem. And with that, I'll end. And then turn it over and hopefully we'll have some time for questions.
You said we just needed to unplug this and talk this in?
Yeah, plug this in and plug it in over here.
I'm not sure what you were planning on talking about, but would it be useful for me to fill in some of the blanks that he left in terms of the total to pets and that type of thing?
I have some of them.
So okay, so
if you want, you can sort of see.
I'll do that.
So whatever. Whatever you have.
Okay, I'll just fill in anything at the end of yours.
That'll be fun because God knows, you know, that's my place. Okay. Okay. I'm a veterinarian, as you know. Dr. Royal is my name. I will say that I had originally thought about going to law school, and the reason I really didn't go to law school was because you don't have any pictures in your books. And I was like, that is not going to work for me. So I have a lot of pictures in this, just for fun stuff to look at, whatever, but that's sort of just one of the most important things in my life is visual stuff. When I'm looking, I've sort of started looking at nutrition specifically because I did a lot of work with zoo medicine, and in zoo medicine, the most important thing for health is nutrition. And so we were constantly thinking all the time, you know, okay, what's the perfect diet for that animal? And, you know, oh my gosh, they got a little bit sick, they had an allergy, it's the food, you know, and we would do that all the time. And then I went to vet school, came out of vet school, and the only thing I learned about nutrition at that point was dogs eat dog food, cats eat cat food. And that was it. And I trusted the industry to tell me what they ate without ever thinking about it again. I mean, nutrition is a semester, and they come in and they say, the Hills and Science Diet Rep will be in, they'll show you their information, and then we're going to move on to cows and chickens and pigs. So it's a really odd thing, because I left all that information I'd already learned at the door and started just feeding these animals. I mean, they're carnivores, and we started feeding them foods that, in a certain sense, when I finally really looked at this, I developed an index. And this is part of it, I don't know if anyone ever is interested in looking at it, but I brought it for fun, of over 2,000 foods that are out there. All of the ingredients, things I don't like and do like, things that I would want to use, percentages of protein, things like that, over months and months of crazy work. All the foods that are out there, and less than 15% of them are foods I would even feed to a dog. And I've got one for cats, too. So, I mean, that was pretty frustrating, and so that makes me wonder, when we're talking about this whole melamine thing and everything else, where the standards are for nutrition in general for dogs and cats. That's part of our problem. Why is so much wheat gluten in there? So, you know, that sort of is where I started with. But that's my place. As we said, this is a huge industry. There's so much money in it that there's definitely room for corruption. And it's just that people want to make money, and it's not necessarily that everybody's, you know, in it in collusion. They're just trying to do the best they can. They're trying to increase the protein level or whatever. It just, it does happen. But, you know, we have these animals, and they are, to us, any of you that have pets, and they're pretty priceless. They're really important, and we trust this industry to regulate itself, and it's not really doing it. So, you know, and why the reason that these animals are so vulnerable is not just because we're these aren't dogs or cats, you know that. Peregrine falcons in them. They're vulnerable because we feed them this food all the time. The food we get the food and we give it to them their whole life. And you know, animals in the wild or whatever would be picking and choosing. That made me ill last time. I'm going to move over here. So they're very vulnerable. They're entirely dependent on our abilities and the abilities of the industry. So it's a big deal, and they, you know, depend on the veterinarians who do it. So when we're outsourcing all of our, you know, foods to countries that have even less regulation than we have, and I think that, you know, the point is valid that we really need to work on regulation in this country and make more, but it's even worse in some of these other countries, and we obviously then we ended up with our problem. Our laws and guidelines and standards are really, they're not very clear. I don't think that they're even that effective, particularly when you, as a veterinarian, we're taught that the AFCO is the company that tells us that a food's okay. And that company, we actually looked at what they do, and I'll explain that in a second. Sorry, I'm being odd, but I'll explain why AFCO doesn't really do the job that they're supposed to do. But then there's also issues of, you know, how we monitor diseases as veterinarians. We don't really communicate that well with each other, so we'll maybe have something happen like the melamine issue, and veterinarians weren't communicating well enough. So there were definitely cases that were missed that should have, if we had a better communication, we would do better. When you have a company that provides the raw materials to a million different foods, and you have maybe six animals come in, but they're all eating something different, so it couldn't be the food. I mean, that's a problem, right? The recalls were delayed a little bit, so the problem became really obvious, and that's when all the issues happened. And then I think sometimes some people really did make some effort to try not to talk about where the trail led to, and although I think the FDA actually agreed with me, sort of finding that. And I think often it, with things like melamine, the risk is worth it. Oops, that's one of my favorite slides altogether. Yeah. It's because there's so much money involved. But and then we also have the problem when we're dealing with these things from a legal standpoint. When the animals are injured, how do you define how much value each of these animals have? And in this, at least in Illinois, I believe animals are still just considered property, so there isn't a lot of recourse for people when their animals get ill or die. It's such a nightmare because there's politics and everything else involved. And then of course, and everybody's seen them now. There's the problem with the milk formulas in China. That's been killing babies too, so clearly it's not just because we don't care about pets, it's just that profit's really important to everybody. So AFCO is one of the companies that I just sort of laugh about in a way, because when I was in vet school, I believed, you know, AFCO, that is it AFCO? Oh, okay, then it's fine. Is it AFCO? Well, it's fine. And on the label, so AFCO approved. But this is what AFCO, the rules are. They have to be... 8 dogs older than a year, they start the test, they have to be normal weight, then they do a blood test, the beginning and the end, then they eat the food, only that food, and then they, when they finish the test, they can't lose more than 15% of their body weight. During the test, they can't die and they can't be removed. And if 6 of the 8 dogs finish the test, they're AFCO. So in my opinion, they take a blood test and weigh them. And that's enough. It's about survival of 6 months of a food in a scavenger animal that does very well with poor nutrition to survive. It's not about quality of health at all. So it's a little distressing to me. So when we're feeding, knowing what we're feeding, how much, you know, we've got obesity problems, we've got all kinds of things. And that's Appy, an elephant, not a dog or cat. But the issue is knowing what we're feeding and what the animal is. It's important. And knowing that this is a carnivore and being aware of that, this is part of our problem with these food recalls and everything, is to know what was an appropriate food in the first place. You know, should there have been something else put into there in the first place? Ingredient lists aren't always what they seem. You know, there are a lot of things. The largest quantity of something is at the top, and then they go down. And they'll often, separate out some of the ingredients to make it look like there's less of it. So there's, cornmeal, corn syrup, corn, this and that. It's all, so it's way down at the bottom. But actually, corn is the number one ingredient in the food for a carnivore. Or they'll do the same with wheat. A lot of marketing tools, they'll say, there's no wheat in here, but there's spelt. Well, spelt's a wheat. No corn's in here. Oh, it's maize, though. Well, that's Spanish. So there's a lot of issues with these things that they do. It's a lot of marketing and a lot of craziness that happens. And then you have, who do you trust? Is it the industry? Do we trust Paul Newman, rest his soul? Dr. Weil, who, is supposed to be Mr. Holistic Alternative. Cesar Millan, who do we trust? These are all people that are out there. And then what kind of liability do they have for recommending this food? None, really. They just come out and say it's good. I don't recommend any of these. Actually, Paul Newman's canned is not so bad. And we talked a little bit. You talked a little bit about how it's the combination of the melamine. So when we're talking about trust, it's like you're saying, okay, what are they putting into these foods, and is any combination of things put together going to cause a problem? And it may. It very well may. So clearly, with the melamine, it's an issue. And Procter & Gamble did do a lot of the research on that. From my veterinary information, we do have some counts, and that's just through the veterinarians that have treated a lot of these animals. And so we found it's over 4,000 pets were died, reported from veterinarians to say that they actually died, and they believe that that was the cause of death. And they're saying that probably about 14,000 animals at least were affected in some way, which is pretty shocking, particularly if you're one of those people that has one of those pets. I think I saw at least 15 severe cases of this that we hospitalized and did a lot of serious medicine and brought them through. I only lost one, and the one that I lost was because it was in February, and everything really sort of hit the fan in March. And had I known that there was a recall, we went through everything. I said, "You sure the cat hasn't eaten a plant? Are you sure that there was? It's an indoor cat. Are you sure? Because this looks so much like a cat. No, the cat lives at home. He's 15 years old. He's never does anything. He's never eaten anything. Wow, it's so weird for him to have a sudden kidney failure like this. It's so weird. And here's what we can do, but I can't tell you what's going to happen." So they decided to euthanize. And I definitely would have advised them something different. I know that is repeated throughout veterinarians. That it was early and sad. And a lot of people didn't ever receive any recompense, or if they did, they got a very small percentage of the hospital bills that were there. A lot of people spent hours and hours filing, calling, doing what they could to try to get repaid for some of this, and they didn't. It was really frustrating. As a veterinarian, I was like, well, I know what caused it, and I know it's not your fault, and here's your bill. You feel like a jerk. So a lot of veterinarians are the ones who ended up taking the hit for this, because we couldn't charge people. I didn't, because whatever, it's so bad for people. So again, there's no way to really sue. That's a dumb thing. But the idea about outsourcing and saying that you were saying how they've all been bulldozed in China. Who's going to be really responsible for this? There's some big issues about how quickly things just sort of disappear when there's a problem. Menu Foods, has talked a lot about how much this cost their company, but the fact is they didn't go down the toilet. They actually did restock, and they are a lot of the foods are back up. So people really took the hit on this one. There's a new recall now. So you were saying amazing. They're still putting it in the fish feed. I'm like, amazing. They're still putting it into the biscuits. So that was just how long ago? A few days ago. So that's pretty distressing. And that's the new one. And then, there's all kinds of timelines about all the different things, the settlement agreements, all these different things that supposedly they were happening, they were going, they were doing it. but really nothing trickled down to people. So as far as it gets, you know, to the responsible, the responsibility for it and helping, you know, individuals, again, I'm looking at my clients and saying, well, there's all this action going on, and I'm sorry you're not seeing any of it. But, you know, there was a lot. There certainly was a lot of cartoons about it, a lot of jokes, you know, which sort of shows you how that it is. So it is was a really, really much more common event, not just because it was in the news everywhere, but a lot of people were really affected by it. You know, even the people that I knew that worked in the pet stores, I had a lot of my staff actually sort of, they'll have come from working in a pet store and said, oh gosh, that was such a horrible time. We were pulling things off the shelves, people were freaking out, you know, that people coming in crying, and it was a horrible thing that happened. So, you know, from a personal standpoint, I was really unhappy about it. But just so that you're aware, this is an industry that's not getting any less. The money that people are putting into their pets is intense. You know, this is Spike, who's 13 years old, couldn't walk when he came to my clinic. But, you know, this owner, she's not wealthy, but she loves this dog. And to get him walking again was everything that mattered to her. And we did. But, you know, I know she spent, you know, within a few months, you know, over $1,000 just doing this for this dog. So people are really, you know, they're spending more on pets. I mean, it's, you know, acupuncture, there you go, see acupuncture. People come in for, you know, routine acupuncture. They need, you know, tune-ups, or they want to get circulation. I did so much acupuncture on these animals for their kidney problems because it helps circulate, you know, blood to the kidneys when they're having a kidney failure problem. That was pretty intense, the amount that people, the lengths that people would go to. People drove 2 or 3 hours to come and see me with animals that were affected by the toxin. So, you know, but you can see that, yeah. Here we go, acupuncture. And then we just for grins, we have the cat.
Oh.
Hold on, we'll do that so you have
it. Sorry.
That's Lance. And Lance was one of those that also, actually, he was mildly affected by the toxin. He was only a year old, but he wasn't in the pool for that. He also fell down 3 flights of stairs and had a spinal contusion. He's supposed to not walk again either, but he's again walking. But again, the owner for these pets, you know, they had this cat was in the hospital for 3 days on IV fluids because of the melamine in the pool on fluids, walking. You know, it's people want to spend money on their pets. They're doing it. It's really happening. So this is not just something that's going to go away. I mean, we are now doing yoga with pets too. So, you know, from a personal standpoint, there's a lot going on with pets and animal law and this kind of thing. We really are going to have to be much more careful how we take care of them. So for me, I do think that, you know, having better regulation, better laws, better oversight, is going to make a huge difference. In my studies of nutrition, I you know, looked at so much, so many products. Eukanuba has one that's, you know, for a carnivore, and it's 2% protein. It's considered a food that you should feed. It's AFCO certified, but this is a carnivore who has some, they're feeding the 2% protein. That doesn't make any sense. For me, it has to be at least over 30% protein. So, you know, there's so much out there that has to be done just to get foods up to standards. And they're not necessarily the most expensive foods. Often they're just normal foods. As long as it's real food products and real things that the body recognizes, that's what you need. And then you don't worry about having things like melamine and things like that in there because it, you know, they wouldn't normally be eating that. So I think that's it for me. Oh, there's my family. You don't have to see that. So anyway. You coming up?
Should I take 5 minutes or should I?
Yeah,
okay. I'll just add a few things in terms of context. I don't know how many people were, you know, very familiar with the recall. I won't even bother to do my PowerPoint. But so the recall happened in March 2007 when Menu Foods, again a Canadian company, recalled about 60 million containers of dog and cat food. That is a lot of pet food. And within 4 months, we have over 1,000 brands of food being recalled in this country. And that includes some of the most trusted brands in the marketplace. We're not talking about just cheap food here. We're talking the whole spectrum from the cheapest food that you'd buy at Walmart to the most expensive stuff that you'd buy at a specialty veterinary office. So it's a lot of food that was affected. again, Dr. McChesney explained the thing with the melamine being added. I'll just go over that quickly, just in case people didn't understand what was being said. Basically, these two Chinese manufacturers were taking a very cheap protein source, ordinary wheat flour. They were lacing it with melamine and trying to sell it, and they were selling it as a more expensive and higher quality protein source called wheat gluten. Just to give you an indication, melamine costs about $1.20 per protein count per ton. A real protein source costs about $6 or $7 per protein count per ton. So this was done purely for economic incentive. It's something that was widespread, and it continues to be widespread in China. It's a long-standing practice. It's not regulated. Of course, either of those toxins, both the melamine or the cyanuric acid, are illegal. They cannot be present in any foodstuffs earmarked for the U.S. market. So I think that raises some pretty troubling questions about the inspection of international foodstuffs and also about food safety in general. And if you have any questions about that, we can talk about that. Just in terms of contextualizing it, something was already said about the toll in terms of pets. The numbers are unconfirmed. There was no national reporting body available at the time for people to report illness and deaths. Again, it ranges from the hundreds to anywhere, you know, from 2,000 to 7,000 or 8,000. It's very difficult to get a good indication of just how many, certainly in the hundreds. Also, I think it's important to know that this wasn't a shot in the dark. The pet food recall, I mean, yes, it grew into the largest consumer recall in U.S. history. It put a bright light on Chinese imports. I mean, there was an international trade scandal. You probably remember the scandal with the lead paint in children's toys, the toxins in Chinese manufactured toothpaste. There was the indictment of, you know, Chinese and U.S. companies for importing prohibited ingredients, this type of thing. But, you know, 3 years earlier, you had a very similar recall in some Asian countries where thousands of pets died. Turns out it was the exact same practice. Melamine was being added to wheat flour to pass it off as wheat gluten. And that's not to mention the dozens of recalls that had happened before that, not necessarily for melamine, but for other substances that had no business being in pet food, but made their way into pet food. They just affected a smaller number of products, affected a smaller number of pets. So, you know, it just didn't gain the same public attention. And none of that actually speaks to the toxins that routinely make their way into pet foods on a regular basis without raising any alarm bells whatsoever, and ranging from sodium pentobarbital, which I don't know how many people of you know what that is, but that's the agent that they use to euthanize mostly companion animals, to rat poison. And then there are poisons that make their way into pet food as part of industry-wide standards, and these are a lot of the preservatives like BHT, BHA, ethoxyquin. All of these things have been linked in the scientific literature to, you know, anything from skin conditions to cancer, and yet it's perfectly legal for companies to put these in their products. And I want to leave enough time for questions. Some stuff was said about AFCO. I hope everyone, it's a non-governmental organization. Again, it's the Association of American Feed Control Officials. They set the standards and for what's supposed to go into pet food. This is not something, they don't have any regulatory function. They can't force companies to adopt these, but what has happened is their model bill has been adopted into law by most of the states in this country, and so that's how it gets enforced. But again, nobody is really minding the store. Not the FDA, not AFCO, not the Pet Food Institute, which is the mouthpiece for the industry. Nobody's actually looking into the quality of these ingredients. What they're looking at is content. If there's a certain percentage of protein, is there a certain percentage of whatever ingredient you want to talk about? So what that means is whether you're using high quality chicken ingredients or rice gluten, wheat gluten as your source of protein, it makes no difference as long as you have a certain percentage in the food. And that's, you know, that's as far as the regulations take us in terms of determining what actually goes into pet food. I don't know. I think that's pretty much all I wanted to add to the context. I think both Dr. McChesney and Dr. Royal did a good job explaining everything else. I don't know if anybody has any questions for the panelists or what. But anybody?
I have a question. Where's your practice?
My practice is at Irving Park and near Western, right on the river. I probably have cards. I have a website,
well-treatedbestbuy.com,
which has a lot of nutrition stuff.
So I'm not clear on how the FDA learns about
through the complaint process? Is that how it works? And if so, is there a specific sort of organizational pathway or organization or informational relationship that you have with veterinarians or doctors so that you know that you're getting the right kind of information in the complaints?
What about a few ways? One, we're out there, FDA is out there doing surveillance, call surveillance sample. So you might pick up the product and analyze it and find something. That's one way. The other way would be consumer complaints. We do call in, my head's sick of work. But that was one of the problems that was pointed out in this, is that on the food side of the house, on the animal food side, also actually on the human food side, there are no reporting requirements. So even if you bought product X and called up the manufacturer, there's no requirement for them to report, that you report to them there's a problem. On the drug side of the house, on both the animal side and the human side, if a veterinarian experiences a problem with the drug, and reports that to the drug company, the drug manufacturer, they are required by law to report the FDA. So that's that pattern. Most of the complaints that we got would come into local FDA offices, and then they would be passed on, so a pet food would come to our center.
And those would have been from people whose pets got sick, who talked to veterinarians, who told them they would probably the pet food? Or?
Well, it would be people who took an animal to their vet, or maybe didn't. They just, the cat who was doing perfectly fine all of a sudden was sick, called the vet. So we've got lots of calls like that. And one thing that was pointed out, and it really, I think, goes to your point, is that there's no uniform reporting form, for lack of a better word, to say, well, if you call up, should someone ask you a set list of questions and fill it out? And that's what we found. We had lots of people whose animals became ill sending their medical records. Veterinarians sent in what they had. They sent in their lab results. They sent it all. But it was there were so many holes in it, you just couldn't make any, you couldn't really tell. And what Barbara pointed out when she started talking about, nutrition, I heard it was like, a couple of, it was a two-week class or something in med school, and that was it. What most of the vet reports that we got on the clinical information lack information on the food the animals eat. And you say, what is feeding? And the answer that most people will give you is what they'll go open the closet door and what's ever in there at that time. Well, that's what I'm feeding. And that may be true for the past 6 months, but it could be that, they were in Walmart, they needed food, and they just bought that, and they went by a non-Walmart brand. So there was just the information. I mean, we sat down and tried to analyze this and spent hours, or, literally weeks trying to do this, and finally realized that it was just, you couldn't do it. You have to make so many assumptions that what would come out just wasn't, it wouldn't be meaningful. It could be misleading.
We felt, and as veterinarians too, I think that all of us sort of went, wow, we really need to be first asking when they walk in the door, what are you feeding? And then get onto the record. But it's not something that's trained, and it's certainly not out there yet. I mean, I get records all the time as a specialist from veterinarians, and they give me all the stuff, but nobody at the clinic, nobody else knows what they're feeding unless they're on a prescription diet that they sell there, which is not that common. So it's very difficult. Veterinarians are not keeping track. And when you do feed them one thing all the time, every day, it's important to know what that is.
And it's not, and I don't know that nutritional history is surely not widely taught. It's taught in a few veterinary schools, and practices like Waterbury seems to be very aware of nutrition, but in general it's not a different thing. And I would put to you that it's probably not a thing that if you go see your doctor, they sit down and ask you for a complete nutritional history of what you're eating. Or even if you have children, the pediatrician probably doesn't ask you that either.
So I think, looking like they're dying.
Yeah, so nutrition I think is just a really truly misunderstood impact.
You're missing the boat on it, because it's a big deal.
So we are working, that's a long answer, we are working on a form to give the folks that when someone calls, you'd ask a standard set of answers, standard set of questions.
Okay.
Can I just, I just want to say two more things to link it back to the animal welfare issue. There are 63% of U.S. homes own at least one pet. That's 71 million homes. We've got 75 million dogs in this country, 88 million cats. So I think the potential for another, or the potential harm for another recall is clearly tremendous. That's the one thing. And then Dr. Royal mentioned some of the practices that the industry uses, like the splitting of ingredients to sort of fool consumers into buying foods that they otherwise might not purchase. I just want to comment on that. After the recall, consumers were aware of certain things that they should look for that they didn't want their food to have, wheat gluten being one of those things. And so companies actually, I have, I guess, a much more negative assessment of the industry than has been presented thus far, I guess. Manufacturers were actually saying that their foods contain no ingredients from China or no wheat gluten. And again, they were just changing, they were using a different name for it. And when pushed on the issue, a lot of these same manufacturers had to admit that not only was the product wheat gluten-based, but it was coming from Chinese sources. I think that is very underhanded. I think that it's a fraudulent practice. And that continues to happen, as you see with the melamine to dog biscuits that Dr. Royal mentioned.
It's so profit-motivated and not nutrition-motivated. So, in my opinion, if you're talking about a carnivore, there should never be any reason to have any wheat or corn product, or, you know, rice can be useful for some reason, but some of the rice things that they mix in, they have no reason to be in those foods. So, in fact, it's also associated with obesity, diabetes, allergies, other problems. So,
yeah, and this is a $17 billion a year industry, and 90% of pet food sales continue to be foods that are primarily wheat gluten-based. So this isn't a problem that's gone away. So I just... Go ahead. There was a question right there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll make this one fairly quick. This is for Dr. McChesney, and I'm, as a theoretical matter, I'm interested in the way you think about regulating food products produced in a foreign country, and pet food is one example of that. As a theoretical matter, I can think of four basic approaches. I'd call them inspection, certification, supervision, self-regulation. You can either look at products and test them using some sampling method when they get into the United States. You can reach some kind of agreement with the foreign government, as I believe we do with a number of Western European countries, to trust their own domestic food or pet food regulators. You can send our own inspectors over to that country to try to supervise what they're doing, as you've tried to do more recently with the somewhat path-breaking memorandum of agreement with China, or you can rely on industry to self-regulate, perhaps with fairly strict penalties. And I'm curious about over the long term. I know that the White House import strategy that came out in the past year or two focused significantly on increasing the degree to which we sent our own people abroad to inspect products and supervise them throughout the production cycle. And I'm wondering about the extent to which, from a pet food perspective, that's a sustainable strategy over the long term, or if CBM is eventually going to have to move back toward relying more on, particularly in China, on the local authority, on pressuring the local authorities to increase their regulatory oversight.
A couple things. Before you outline your, I agree with your good approaches, or potential approaches. Testing, while conceptually very good, you really only test for things you know, and it's always hard to find. You wouldn't have been testing for melanin because you don't think to test it that well. So like, until you know something, then you're not going to, it's unlikely to look for it. It's that something can always do something you're not looking for, that testing won't pick up. So it's got some merits for what we know, but not on the other side. For industry to self-regulate is, they need some parameters if they're going to do that. And that needs to be, obviously, more regulation, because if we all own companies in this room, and we were asked all to self-regulate, you would probably regulate. So, you regulate yourself to some, to whatever you felt your own appropriate standards for your company was. So that leaves us FDA doing more inspections or third-party inspections, whether they're countries or independent associations. FDA looked at, for budgeting purposes, out to like 2012, 2015. If we said we want to inspect everybody, you know, what would that look like? And the big driver, and that was all across all of FDA. And the big drivers in that were human foods and pet food, or animal feeds. There aren't that many drug manufacturers around the world, so they were the big drivers. And the bill to do what we wanted was like $3 billion. It was huge. So that's like a budget killer. I mean, we don't, our whole budget isn't that much. So that's conceptually a good approach, but it's not financially feasible, I don't think. So we need some mix of that. And the mix of that is some type of third-party inspection. If you do third-party inspection, you need to hold them to a standard that whatever we agree to is the correct standard. If FDA was going to there to look, what's our standard, then third party should inspect to that standard. And that's what you need to develop. And that's what we're working on. And it's becoming, China is not doing well. We have an MOA with them, and I was on folks that negotiated that, and it's been total disillusionment now. Yeah.
Sure. Also, yeah, in addition to that, the standard right now for what is allowable for pet food is crazy anyway. Yeah. If you look at these foods, and they're even 10% protein, 12% protein, they're ASCO and everything else. Some of that has to change too, though. But yeah.
So we need better standards, and for just to answer your question broadly for the food supply, my view is that some type of third party inspection is where this is going, but there's third parties that are doing it would be held to the standard. So you have third party organization and you would audit, FDA would audit that third party. Are you performing inspections, you know, up to our standards?
So you're thinking of some kind of private sector third party organization rather than looking to the foreign government?
Well, third party could be either. It could be either the foreign government or independent one. And I mean, that was one model in China, but China definitely refused independent third party. They said, as a government, we want to do it, and that's not working so well. We're not even into that mode, but the agreement that said we'll work on this is we're sort of disillusioned with that because it appears there are. It's one thing to do it in pet food, and it's not a good thing, but when the practice goes on in human food products that are going to infants and children, that just says the system's broken, right? I mean, you can't, the regulatory system is just broken, and you really can't, I don't know how you would, you would reestablish confidence in that if we said go over there and do inspection. You know, if I came here and said, well, we just certified them, would you believe it?
Are there next steps right now if the MOA isn't working the way we thought it was?
We've given them third-party inspection criteria that FDA has. And it's the same criteria that we use when states do inspections for FDA. And the states are working through it. And it's got laboratory pieces in it. It's got training. It's got conflict of interest. That's 12 steps now, and I can give Vince the link for if you give me
the
email. I'll be happy to send you the link or share it at school. It's a public document. So that's where it's going, to hold these folks to those standards, and it's not going. I mean, they're just not even close. So there'll be some more information coming out on Monday.
Do you
still
have a
question?
Yeah, I just want to say, I think, as far as the whole wheat gluten issue, I think we get on really shaky ground with that. You know, if we're going to shaky ground to begin with to say that animals shouldn't consume any wheat, obviously that's a sort of contentious issue. And I defer to your veterinary knowledge on that, and I won't take you up on it. But I think it's problematic to say that people wouldn't buy a certain pet product if they knew what was really in it, that the masking, I think it's not that they even bother to mask it, because I think most people don't even think about it at all, like don't even read the ingredients. And you know, I mean, I buy a dog food like Solid Gold that I have to go to, well, actually Solid Gold's not a good example because they sell it at Petco now, but you know, if I buy a dog food like Merrick or whatever, I have to go to a specialty store for. A lot of those foods have wheat gluten in them too. So it's like, what are you excited?
It's an issue.
Does everybody have to feed their dog raw? You know, and I think what it makes, where you make it tricky is like, so okay, we're gonna, if people don't care enough about what's in their dog food, they're too willing to just feed the dog whatever, just because they don't realize or whatever. So we need to put regulations on it that raise the bar for all dog food. So, and maybe that regulation should be no wheat products whatsoever ever in any dog food. Is that going to, I mean, I don't know enough about the economics of that industry. Is that going to, like, just up price every single dog food out there and make it?
There certainly has to be some sort of a moderate approach to it in some ways, but I do feel like there's definitely something better we can do rather than saying, well, let's trust the fact that the label's really big and it says organic, you know?
I think the point that I was trying to make, and maybe to a large extent this doesn't happen anymore, but there was a point after the recall that people were looking for those ingredients specifically, and they wanted to buy foods that didn't contain those things, and the industry responded by masking those ingredients rather than changing their standards. And so that's what I was talking about.
Just in my experience, I think it really stinks. Like, you know, someone like my mom or a lot of people I know are just really intelligent, love their animals, adore them as much as anyone could. You know, get real worried about the fact that, oh no, I'm feeding my dog Yukonuba, then when the whole thing blows over, I'm switching my dog to Beneful. You know, just because Beneful was not recalled doesn't mean that it's any better quality of dog food, you know.
And people want, they want to be told, in a certain sense, my clients come to me and say, I don't care what it is, what the reason is, what's behind it, tell me what to feed my dog, because I don't want to think about this, because it's their dog. Why should they be reading labels and spending hours, and you know, I mean, in a certain sense, as a veterinarian, I think it is my job to make sure that what goes into them is appropriate. And I think pediatricians should help you to feed your child appropriately. So
I think it's important that labels should be easily, when you read them, they are easily understandable, as opposed to just understandable. You understand what words mean, but it doesn't mean nutrition. So I think we should mention that the labels, people are encouraged to read the labels. And people ought to think about nutrition, because a lot of what we say is in the marketing things. Now, I mean, we have people call us out, or call our experts and say, I'm a vegetarian. I want to feed my dog a vegetarian diet, or my cat. And you know, dogs are scavengers. Cats are one of the few true carnivores in the world. You know, a cat just doesn't really want to eat corn. He's a corn. So I mean, you really have to separate people's, you know, habits there. They realize that what may be good for you or I, and you know, make a decision to be a vegetarian. You know, I kind of balance my diet with other things, where you go over cat. That's all we're getting. So it's very difficult, I think, and I commend her for what she's doing in her practice, to get people off of like, well, you know, I want, this is what I am, I want my dog to be the same as cat because I think it's healthy. I mean, that's a tough one.
I would caveat that I think you can do it, not so much with cats, but with dogs, with you, but you have to try really, 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 really hard, extra hard to do it right.
There's definitely ways to do it with dogs. I still don't find that they're that healthy. I don't think we've got a good way to do it. So I'm still believing we have a carnivore. If I have a hummingbird, I'm not going to feed it steak. You know, you try to feed, well, that's why there's different species and different things on the planet. We really do need to
think. I don't feel my dog.
Yeah, but I do, I mean, people say that you can do it, I still haven't seen it be that healthy. They'll survive. But again, I deal with health, not survival so much. And it's, you know, more about health.
Any other questions? Right, well, thank you both for coming today. That was great.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.